All right, so we're here for an episode of Going Deep in our fancy new studio. Today we're focusing on application virtualization with...
John Sheehan.
All right.
I'm the architect for the Microsoft application virtualization product.
Excellent. Now, you have a history with Softricity.
Right. So Softricity was a company that we had a product called SoftGrid. And mm-hmm. SoftGrid was an application virtualization product. And we got bought by Microsoft about... almost 2 years ago. It would be 2 years, end of July.
Excellent. So let's talk, you know, for people in the audience who don't, you know, we talk about virtualization quite a bit on Channel 9, actually, but it's machine virtualization.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this layer. What? Give me some scenarios. What's the use of this stuff?
Well, application virtualization is fairly similar to machine virtualization. We just mm-hmm. do it at a different level in the stack.
Mm-hmm.
So machine virtualization, you're basically virtualizing the hardware. And what you run is an entire operating system on top of machine virtualization. With application virtualization, we don't virtualize the entire stack. We virtualize at the operating system level.
Mm.
And so the goals of application virtualization are a little bit different than for machine virtualization. What we're trying to do is to decouple the application from the operating system. And by doing that, we can enable a lot of really interesting scenarios. Mm. So one of them we term click to run. And with click to run, you can basically sit down at a machine that has our client on it and decide you want to use an application. And let's say it's like Office 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And if your IT department has made Office 2007 available virtually, mm-hmm. you can go up and click a link that's that says Word 2007. Mm-hmm. And in usually under 10 seconds, you have Word up and running and you can start typing.
Interesting.
And so it's kind of, yeah, it's interesting because obviously Office is a very large package. And we didn't come up with some technology that can bring down, you know, 2 gigabytes of data in 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
What we're really doing is we're bringing down just the bits of Word that need to run, that you need to get Word up and running initially. And then from there, we can demand page and anything else that's needed because it's really running on your system. It's not like terminal services where you need a server on the back end mm-hmm. to run the app. The app's physically running on your machine. And so we can get that, you know, that 10-second experience and get you up and running. And then behind the scenes, we can bring down the rest of Office. We can trickle it down. And then once you have all the bits of Office, you can unplug from the network. You can do what I do, which is get on an airplane a lot with your laptop, and Office is there and it's running. And you really can't tell the difference because, you know, you have the start menu looks like it always does. If you double-click on a Word document, it works. And so, you know, as far as the user's concerned, the application is installed. But if you actually went and started poking around the machine other than, you know, the start menu and stuff and looked for winword.exe or you went and looked for all the registry keys, mm-hmm. none of those things would be there.
What would it look like in the process manager?
It's just you see winword.exe. So
okay.
If you pull up the process manager, it's a real process. It's physically running on your machine.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really happening is that we've built up what we call a virtual environment. And a virtual environment is it's a view of the world where inside that virtual environment, all of the resources that Office expects to see are there. So if it looks around, it sees all of its files, it sees its registry entries. If it creates a COM object, it all just works, even though on the local system, none of those things are there. And really, that's where the virtualization piece comes in, right? Because what we're doing is we are taking that environment that, you know, environment that would have Office installed mm-hmm. and making it available to the application at runtime.
Hmm.
You know, in reality, you know, I refer to it as we lie, right? Mm-hmm. So we lie to the application. The application says, you know, oh, I want, you know, this file or this registry key, and we basically make those things available.
Interesting. Very interesting, because when an application initializes, usually the first thing that it does is it tries to grab in all of its, you know, DLLs that it needs and all of its libraries, and then if it doesn't find one, it throws an exception.
Right.
So what you're saying is, even though the DLL might not physically be available to the process that's asking for it, you lie to it or you demand grab it and stick it in?
No, we do. So it's at two levels. There's
okay.
the, you know, what we really end up doing is we're a big namespace manager.
Mm.
So the, you know, when you hear things like DLL hell and conflict and all of those things, right? What they're really talking about is I have two different resources, like two different versions of a DLL, and I want them to have the same, or I need them to have the same name.
Mm-hmm.
And in Windows, that's impossible because Windows only has one namespace. So every file, you know, that has that name, you can only have one of them. And so with SoftGrid, we actually have lots of namespaces. So when you create a virtual package, and I'll tell you about that, how we kind of do that in a minute.
Sure.
But when you create one of those, what you're really doing is you're creating a namespace. And that namespace contains all the resources with the names that they would normally have if the application was locally installed. And then when you, you know, click to run that application or you run that virtual application, we take that namespace and we effectively layer it on top of the local namespace, and we do what we call composition, which is the view of the world inside that virtual environment is a sort of a blended view of all the resources that the application needs, you know, that it would have installed, along with everything that's there locally.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why when the application looks around at all the name at the namespace, it sees everything that it's used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And the tricky part about that is, applications expect there only to be one namespace, right? Every Windows app in the world just unconsciously expects there to be one namespace. They have no concept of having more than one. Mm-hmm. And so what we have to do is take these multiple namespaces and compose them in a way that it's coherent and it obeys all of the invariants that you would expect it to have. So for example, if there was a resource in the virtual environment with a name and there's one on the local system with a name, if I enumerate that container, I shouldn't see two with the same name. That would be nonsensical. And so we have to do a lot of work. Or if I delete something in the virtual environment and there also happens to be one locally, I shouldn't then look and see it again, right? So we have to do things like persist deletions and, you know, keep track of the fact that this resource has been deleted and don't allow some local thing to shine through.
Interesting. So, of course, Word isn't particularly useful unless you can save the data.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work?
So, you know, I always say that we want your config, mm-hmm. but we don't want your data. And so the way it works is applications store their configuration in certain locations. And those locations are really mapped out at installation time. And so the process of building up a virtual application is a process we call sequencing. It's, you know, we're not great with names, by the way. and so it's called sequencing. And really what you do is you install this part of our product we call the sequencer. And then you just run the install. You say, all right, I'm going to create a new virtual application. You run the install. And what's happening is we're sitting in the kernel and we're basically catching everything. And we're building up that namespace. And then when you're done and you hit save, we persist that namespace out to one big file. And that file basically has a whole bunch of metadata inside it that lets us know what areas of the system the config is stored. And so things like my documents are really anywhere in the system that's not the specific areas where config is stored, mm-hmm. we don't touch. So at runtime, when you're using Word and then you hit save, it goes into your RealMy documents, and then that way you see everything exactly where you would expect it to be,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the ways that we make sure that the experience for the user is seamless. You don't want the user to know that the user doesn't care if it's virtual or real or whatever. They just know that they want to use an application and they can use it.
Mm-hmm.
And with SoftGrid, we reduce all that friction of deployment, which means I can log into any machine and just immediately start using the apps that I'm used to using, and I don't have to go through a process of installing and building up a machine.
Interesting. So in this case, one of the things that I do a lot as a Windows user is, for example, on Vista, I'll look for a document, start, do a search, start, channel 9, whatever, and then a bunch of docs will come up, which I love about Vista, but that's one of the best features.
Mm-hmm.
Click on it. So my question is, shell execute actually does the work of launching the application. So when I save one of these docs from the virtualized experience, what happens when I double click on the .doc file?
Okay. So the way it works is at that sequencing process, we basically collect a whole bunch of metadata about what the application intends to do,
mm-hmm.
including it intends to make itself available through shortcuts. It intends to register a bunch of file type associations. And then an IT organization can, or an enterprise can centrally control that information and say, okay, I register Office 2007 and I make it available to these groups in AD.
Hmm.
Then when we go through a publishing process, which is there's a small agent on your system that basically periodically checks to see if you have any new applications that you've been entitled to. If it finds a new one, it takes that metadata and it registers the application in the local system. But we only register those extension points that the shell really needs to see.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, file type associations and shortcuts. The one interesting thing about the shortcuts, the way we have to register everything, is we can't directly register winword.exe. right? Because, well, two reasons. One, we don't allow people to see WinWord.exe directly. And also, if you just started, if you just called create process on that, there wouldn't be a virtual environment around it. Mm. And so it would start up, it would say, like you said before, I don't see my DLLs, I throw up an error box, and I go away. Mm-hmm. And so the way that we register it is we really register, we have what we call a launcher. It's like an intermediary or a proxy. And that launcher gets registered as actually handling the file type association. And then there's some extra data put on the end of the registration that allows our launcher to know, oh, the thing that's really going to handle this is the virtual version of Word 2007.
Okay.
And so then when you double-click on that document, the shell goes, looks up the file type association, sees the thing that's supposed to launch, and then it goes ahead and calls create process on it. We come into the picture, and then our system goes through and basically builds up the virtual environment, turns around and launches the application and passes the path to the document that needs to get launched.
Excellent. So in the case where I want to run one instance of Word, one instance of Excel, and one instance of something else, mm-hmm. My question is, you don't have any problem with that. I mean, so you're going to create an environment for that will run any... So in other words, sometimes I'm going to want to share data between processes that you say are going to be running in your virtual mm-hmm. environment. So I'm going to want to share data from Excel into Word or something like that. How does that work?
So we build up a virtual environment for it. So I keep saying virtual application. In our terminology, it's really a package. And so the package is Office 2007, right? And so it contains all the different applications in there. And if you launch Word, then Excel, then PowerPoint, then Outlook, those all run inside the same virtual environment. And they have that same coherent view of the world. Mm-hmm. And they can go ahead and just share information to their heart's content.
Okay.
One really interesting thing about SoftGrid is we enable, or Microsoft Application Virtualization. I will always fall back to the SoftGrid thing because it's a nice short way to say it.
Just consider it a code name.
It is. Well, I'm pushing the built-on SoftGrid technology, so then I can, like, people still say NT today.
I'm pushing
the same way.
Good.
But what we end up doing is enabling the ability to, you can actually run Office 2007, Office 2003, XP 2097, all simultaneously on the same machine at the same time.
Awesome.
So you can have every version of Word all the way back running simultaneously. And it's interesting, because the first time we showed it to the Office guys, they just kind of, you know, what did you do? You know, they had no idea, because there's no way you could do that with a regular system, because you would immediately run into conflict, right? And conflict at many levels. There's obviously DLL hell, mm-hmm. but there's all kinds of other conflict as well. Like, when I said we're a big namespace manager, it's not just files and registry. We have to manage a lot of different subsystems. A great example is COM. Mm. And so that class ID, that GUID that represents, some COM object, mm-hmm. that's a name. And Word 2007 and 2003, whatever, they will all want to claim that same name. And within Windows, with only having one namespace, only one application can claim that name. And so if you try to install two different versions, even if you install the files to a different location, that would only solve part of the problem, because you would still have the problem of COM conflict. And another one is just what we call dynamic conflict, which is, if you launch, two different versions of Word, well, they'll go and try to create the same mutex. Hmm. Right, or the same semaphore, or shared memory, or whatever
Absolutely.
They're doing, because every time they create a new version of Word, they don't go in and rename all of their resources, because they don't expect to ever have to deal with that situation. Hmm. And so under the cover, SoftGrid is dealing with the object manager and making sure that those things don't conflict. And it's dealing with COM and making sure that COM doesn't conflict and that COM works the way it would normally work.
Interesting. Now, do you support the notion of supporting, say, backwards compatible services? So I want to run something that's always running on my machine inside of your container that may have some sort of vulnerability associated with it. So that's really what I'm asking.
So, well, two things. We do support NT services. The way that we do NT services, though, is a lot of applications abuse NT services. In other words, they feel that just because you've installed their application on your machine, mm-hmm. that they should be able to use their resources whenever they feel like. And so they always install these NT services, and they do it only because they need to periodically do something. Once a day, once a week, they want to check for updates. Mm. And in Vista, they actually added a lot of support into the task scheduler. as a way for these ISVs to be able to support these, you know, periodic things without having to build an NT service. Because if you build an NT service, it runs all the time. And if you've ever looked in your task manager, you see this huge list of processes.
Yes.
A lot of those are services that, you know, just run every, you know, that don't really need to be a service. Mm. And so we support NT services, but the way that we do it is, when you launch the application, if it's marked as an auto start service, we automatically start it up.
Okay.
And it runs for the lifetime of that virtual environment. When you shut the application down and we take down the virtual environment, we shut down that NT service.
Okay.
And so that means that today we don't really support the, yeah, you know what, when I log in, I always want this thing to run. Now, of course, you could create you could put something in your startup folder that launched, you know, the virtual app hidden and the NT service would run, but that's not really the reason that we do it. But the other part of your question was more around security vulnerability, and we're not a security product. So we're not, you know, we don't tout ourselves as a way to lock down your system. Like, we're not a VM that, you know, a tight sandbox. As I mentioned before, you know, when you write files to your local system, they just go through.
Got it.
So we don't really plan to ever, I mean, we have no plans to ever get in that game because, you know, security is a really, really hard nut to crack, and there are a lot of very smart people working on it. And yeah, maybe you could look at our technologies and say, sure, I could take that and change it and then make it a security product, but that's not really what we're trying to do.
That's excellent. But I mean, I think one of the most interesting immediate uses that come to mind for, say, web developers is I could run a whole number of versions of IE, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because today you can only run one version of Internet Explorer natively on Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so without having to launch up a whole virtual machine and another instance of Vista or XP inside of this pretty big construct, I could just actually click once to run IE6, IE5, IE4, IE3 if I were crazy, and then IE8.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an awesome way for developers. Now, how would that work? Would that work?
Well, so it depends. There are some things that work and some things that wouldn't. First of all, since IE is part of the operating system, we don't, you know, technically support virtualizing IE.
Okay.
But, you know, what's supported and what people do is a funny difference. In other words, we've had lots of people virtualize IE.
Uh-huh.
The bigger challenge is the compatibility issue. Right? Because we're also not an operating system compatibility layer. In other words, if an application doesn't run on XP, right? Let's say it just never worked on XP, virtualizing it usually doesn't all of a sudden make it start working.
Sure.
Sometimes it happens to because of some of the ways we allow you to sort of customize the virtual environment, but we never claim to be an application compatibility layer. So that would be one of the challenges that you would face. If without SoftGrid, you couldn't get that application running on the operating system, there's a reasonable likelihood that you're not going to be able to either. People are really creative, and we've seen people go off and take IE6 and virtualize it, get it running on Vista.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something that we would ever encourage
sure.
people to do, especially not in a production environment. You know, I mean, since we sell to large enterprises, I wouldn't typically expect a large enterprise to go implement a scenario that's completely unsupported.
Understood.
But sometimes they do because they need to.
But I mean, that actually, I mean, the part of the reason I asked the question, and you already said the answer to it, was if you already have, you know, Windows is full of shared components, shared componentry, shared libraries. IE is one of these. IE is actually just a really small EXE.
Mm-hmm.
And it relies on a whole host of system components, right?
Sure.
So DLLs that Office uses, that other applications, ISVs can write MSHTML.dll, applications that want to have something that renders and parses, whatever.
Sure.
So that's really what I was getting at. I mean, if you have an application that requires on native libraries, it's not supported to virtualize it in your context. Whereas if you want to install a complete packaged application like Office. So I'm just trying to rationalize how this works.
It's, you know, I mean, in reality, there's nothing inherent in virtual, you know, app virtualization that would prevent you from virtualizing anything. So maybe, you know, we don't deal with device drivers, mostly because the Windows team doesn't want us, you know, playing in the, you know, start. You don't want to lie to device drivers, because if you ever lie wrong, you'll blue screen, right? Your system's dead. But other than that, there's really nothing inherent in what we do that would prevent you from, you know, virtualizing an application like IE. Mm-hmm. The difference is that because the IE team works so closely, because they're part of the operating system and they work so closely with the Windows team, They really try to leverage Windows, you know, as much as they can, mm-hmm. and so they really do tend to build, you know, OS specific functionality into their application and getting those things to work on versions of Windows that they've never built or installed or tested just mm-hmm. becomes a challenge.
Understood. So, you know, here's a nice whiteboard. It's all clean. You're an architect.
Love
this
whiteboards.
Is going deep. So I think we've definitely adequately introduced this and people kind of understand what's going on, but you know, now I really want to focus on how does it work?
Okay.
Like, let's talk about that.
All right.
That's really interesting.
One of my favorite subjects.
Excellent.
All right. So I'll start at the high level, and then hopefully we have an eraser, and if not, then...
We do have an eraser, and I will find it for you.
All right, great. Well, I'll start at the high level mm-hmm. and talk, you know, talk in the large, and then we'll drill down to the small, because there's really two different sort of levels that most people want to understand software at. There's mm-hmm. the large, which is sort of how do you... do the streaming, and how do you sort of architect a system so that I can click and it starts running. And then the other piece is the virtualization piece. And so at a high level, you know, we basically have a client and we have a server. So it's, you know, really simple, right? And the server's responsibility is basically, it has a whole bunch of little things like authentication and authorization and all that kind of stuff, knowing who's entitled to what. Mm. And that's what, you know, we typically call publishing, right? So publishing is I log in to a brand new system, I've never used it before, and I need to be able to make all my applications look like they're there. Like on my laptop, I have about 150 to 170 applications that are all virtual. The first time I, you know, it's a fairly new laptop. I logged in, I hit a button, and in 10 seconds or so, all 150 apps look like they were there. And so that's really the first half of or the publishing part of our server. The more interesting piece is the streaming. And for streaming, we traditionally supported a protocol called RTSP, and it's like the real-time streaming protocol. And it's an industry standard, but we built our own client implementation, our own server implementation, since there's no like standard implementation out there. This is basically what would allow you to sort of on the fly bring the bits over.
Nice.
Okay? And in our upcoming release, which hasn't shipped yet, but it's about to RC, we have added some support for some other protocols. And the big one is HTTP. So starting in our 4.5 version, you will actually be able to just use IIS or, you know, a web server. And without deploying our, you know, custom server, you'll be able to get all the benefits of streaming and all the performance of streaming for your IIS or through HTTP and HTTPS as well. So
wow.
That really means for a lot of enterprises, we're asking for internet scenarios. Mm-hmm. So they say, I have my central, you know, office, but then I have all these roaming users, or I have a sales guy who works out of his home in Atlanta, and I want him to be able to get his applications, but he's not, you know, we don't have a VPN, or the VPN's too heavy, and I really just want to make this available on the internet. Obviously, we'll protect it through, you know, authentication and everything, but I want to be able to stream over the internet, and so we've done stuff like that.
Excellent.
And in reality, our expectation with 4.5 is that this protocol will probably become the most implemented, purely because people already have IIS servers out there, and they already have built out an IIS infrastructure, and it's something that they're familiar with, and it's something that's very easy for them to manage and troubleshoot, and if the client couldn't connect, they know HTTP, and so it's something that our customers are really excited about. And so, you know, this is a very high level. There's obviously a lot more. We have a management system and stuff, but mm-hmm. That's fairly standard. This is at a high level is kind of how it works.
Okay.
Or how it's laid out. In 4.5, we've done a lot of work to make the server completely optional. So the SCCM team has built integration with SoftGrid. So they sort of, understand virtual applications now, and they can manage them across an enterprise. And if they do that, then you don't need any of our server infrastructure.
Wow.
So this is, you know, this isn't the particularly interesting part of it, but this is just sort of the high level, you know, how bits flow and,
okay.
and stuff.
Cool.
But now we'll get into the actual app virtualization, because that's really the kind of stuff that this whiteboard is very shaky.
It is. It's a nervous whiteboard.
Exactly. All right. So inside of the client, there's a handful of subsystems, and they kind of span user mode and kernel mode. So if you do kind of your standard, you know, diagram where you have user mode, you have kernel mode. In user mode, we have an NT service, and it's basically our, you know, our orchestration engine. SoftGrid is a very loosely coupled system, so we're, you know, I'm a big believer in making sure that you know, all the systems can run independently, and that there's not a lot of dependencies across the different subsystems, because every dependency that you add makes it harder to innovate, it makes it harder just to support and troubleshoot and all those kind of things. And so we have this sort of central service that, you know, sort of is the orchestration engine that says, I have all these other pieces of the system, and I own telling everyone what to do.
Cool.
Down in kernel mode, which is where a lot of the interesting stuff happens, we basically have what we call System Guard, which is the virtualization engine. And then we have our file system. So we actually have a real file system. It's, you know, it's as real a file system as NTFS is, and we register it. And what this buys us today is it buys us the ability to do that streaming. So if paging I.O. comes in, it's the thing that handles the paging I.O. It's the thing that can make the call out and get the information off the network and fulfill the paging I.O. The other interesting thing that it does is it does copy and write per user. So not only do we decouple the applications from the operating system, we use our file system to decouple one user from another. And so that means that each user on the system, even though they share the common bits, what we call the golden image, the namespace that was built at sequencing time, even though they share that, anytime a write comes into a file, we never allow the write through to the to that golden image. We always do a copy on write operation to make sure that, and we put basically into a separate container per user. And so our file system is what enables that.
Excellent.
And one of the other, there's basically a couple of other big pieces. There is, in user mode, we have a transport, which handles all of the network traffic. It basically abstracts away the network from the whole rest of the system. When we put HTTP support into the system, it was a really easy thing to do because none of the system knew anything about any of the protocols, right? They just hand these sort of opaque URI blobs around, and the transport takes that and interprets that. And so when we had to add HTTP, and we also added file support, so you can actually just stream off a file if you want. We added that support. It was really simple because we only had to do it in here. And basically, the orchestration engine is the thing that talks to all the different subsystems. And the, probably the most interesting arrow on the entire diagram is from the file system to our transport, because we actually have to do what's called an upcall. And upcalls, there's no supported way or no standard way in Windows for doing an upcall, right? There's no way for a driver to just say, oh, I want to reach out and touch this one particular user mode application and give it a request. And a lot of that has to do with namespace, with address spaces and stuff, right? Because when the request, if a request comes into the file system, it's probably in the address space of Microsoft Word. And then if it needs to make a call into some other process, there's no sort of standard way of doing that. And so we actually, and other people have had to do this as well, we had to basically build an upcall mechanism that allows that file system to send the request up to the transport.
Now, I would imagine that that was an intentional design of NT to not create an easy way for you to do that, right? I mean, do you not really necessarily want to have kernel mode processes interacting with random things happening in different address spaces, right?
I mean, well, no, I mean, actually, there's a lot of ways in NT in the kernel to be able to look into other address spaces, right? So there's the ability to do that. It's more the, you know, it's not an uncommon pattern, but it's also not a regular pattern, right? There aren't most drivers don't need to call up to a particular one, but it happens all the time. I mean, NT has to do it, right? So NT has ways of doing the same thing, of making up calls to particular user mode processes. And we had to do the same thing. And one main reason we have to do it is all of this runs, right, actually in one NT service, right? So we have an NT service called the listener. And when we're reading data off the network, we want to make sure that no one can, you know, can spoof it or anything like that. And if we were actually making the network calls right from whatever process was running, it could do whatever it wanted to try to sort of affect that, right? And we want to make sure that you can't do that. And the other thing too is that the file system relies on a specific interface and being able to get, you know, sort of repetitive behavior out of it. And you know, if it's having problems communicating to the transport and it can't get the information, well, then the application's not going to be able to keep running. And so it's really important to have a sort of solid interface there. Mm. So, you know, these are kind of like the basic blobs in the system or in the SoftGrid system. System Guard has really two components. So there's the kernel mode component, which mostly does it does our virtual registry. It does our virtual file system. And one very confusing thing is we have a file system and we have a virtual file system. Hmm. They're two completely different components. They pretty much know nothing about each other. Hmm. The file system is a real file system. It stores data. It registers itself as NT as a file system, and it is a file system. Our virtual file system basically it doesn't store any data. It just does the composition and redirection. Mm. So the problem that you have to solve is let's say I take Office and I tell Office I want you to install on my F drive. Go install. That's where I want you to install. Office will go and install on the F drive, but then it puts a whole bunch of stuff on your system drive anyway, under common files and system 32. And so there's no way to get these applications to always put everything in one place, in a place that's not the system drive. And so the virtual file system's responsibility is basically to overlay the local drives and all the local partitions, and if there's some part of the namespace that needs to appear in one of those areas, it is responsible for doing that. And so it's basically a filter that just filters all the file system traffic and does the redirection. And it's very lightweight because it's mostly the create path that matters. You know, once the application gets a handle back to a file, all the I/O, that just goes, and we don't really have to get involved in the I/O. So there's not like a big like performance impact to, you know, we're not filtering and moving around every read and write. We really just need that create path, that initial phase to get set up. Mm. And then in the kernel, there's also a virtual environment manager. And what it does is you initially create, or you through double clicking on that document, we eventually create winword.exe, and we tell System Guard, okay, that virtual environment that we created, put this process in that virtual environment. From that point forward, System Guard takes over the responsibility of ensuring that all the child processes and whatever stay inside that virtual environment. So that if WinWord has to spawn something like the equation editor or Visio or something else, some out of process COM object, or just calls create process on it, and then tries to communicate with it, that they both have a consistent view of the world and that they just work. Okay. And so this thing in the kernel really sort of manages all that. And it also manages the lifetime of the virtual environment. It's a thing that sees, hey, there's no one left in this virtual environment. It's time to shut this thing down and save and persist out all the changes that have been made during this session.
Okay. So let me ask a quick question. Because with machine virtualization, there's no real way today to have two virtual machines communicate. I mean, obviously for security reasons. You could have secure channels to some sort of protected memory or whatever. I'm sure Hypervisor is going to enable something like that. I don't know what the plans are, but
yeah,
my point is, let's assume that I'm running an application not in your virtual environment that's actually using NTFS and really on the system. Now, this is really on the system, but how would communication happen in that case?
Well, in most cases, we prevent the communication, right? Okay. Because the local application doesn't have that same view of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have applications that are both virtual, there are ways in SoftGrid to be able to allow them to communicate. One of them is you can define dependencies. Mm-hmm. So common examples are like, you know, I virtualize the .NET framework, and then I virtualize the .NET app, or I virtualize 50 .NET apps. Mm-hmm. And then what I can do is not put the .NET framework in every single one of those packages, which we used to actually require. So in the older versions of SoftGrid, you would have to package the .NET framework 50 times, and then if they had to patch it, you'd have to patch it 50 times, and that's just a non-starter. Mm-hmm. So what you can do now is say, all right, I can virtualize the .NET framework, then virtualize the 50 apps independently, and then just I can define a dependency between, you know, this package and this is dependent on this package, and then at runtime SoftGrid will see the dependency and we will spin up both and allow them to run in the same virtual environment and see each other. And then for the next one that comes up, we can allow it to see into that virtual environment as well, and therefore we can sort of control that.
Excellent.
You know, and it's one of the areas that moving forward, we're always adding more and more features to the application interaction, allowing people in different virtual environments to communicate with each other, but not to pollute in each other's virtual environments.
Perfect. And Something else that's really interesting, for example, the notion of CTPs, right? So let's say we release a CTP of, you know, some version of Visual Studio that's coming out in a couple of years, right? Mm-hmm. Or a year. So we start doing the CTP stuff. A lot of times CTPs, that leaves detritus on your system that makes it harder to upgrade and stuff. Mm-hmm. So in this context, that's not going to happen, right?
Yeah, if you took the CTP of Visual Studio and packaged it all up, you could do a few things. First of all, you could click to run it. Mm-hmm. That would be really interesting, right?
Absolutely.
Just to be able to say, hey, it starts running in a very short period of time. The way that they get around it with the real CTPs that they ship is they put them in a VM. Mm-hmm. So you have to download an entire Windows installation and everything, and then you have to run it inside that Windows installation. And mm-hmm. and things like the they have like their performance drivers and stuff like that just are a non-starter in a virtual environment. In a VM, because they're not running on the bare metal, and it doesn't work really well. They make a whole bunch of assumptions about the hardware in order to get the timing information, and that's just not going to work well. And so, you know, the user sort of has either I can run an entire heavy VM, and therefore I don't completely mess up my system, or I lay down all this stuff on my system, and who knows what it's going to do.
Yeah.
And in reality, with SoftGrid, the big thing is that, you know, I say installers are evil, right? I mean, when you run an installer, you basically give it permission to do anything to your system that it wants, anything. And you didn't write the install. You don't know what it's going to do. Mm. But no matter what it's going to do, it's going to have to change your operating system. If it's a Windows application, it's going to have to change your operating system. And Windows doesn't have an app model where you can sort of draw a box and say, this is my application, go ahead and run it. I have a whole bunch of files and registry entries and all kinds of junk, and I need to write another program in a completely different language that then is going to go and modify your operating system. And once it does that, there's really no safe way to undo it, right? So there's really no safe way to install, because everyone's had the experience, you run an installer and at the end there's something wrong with your system.
Yeah.
But then there's also no safe way to uninstall, because in the meantime other applications may expect those things to be there. Mm. And so that's sort of the dilemma that we're in today, and that's why you have that problem with Visual Studio is, you know, once you install the CTP, the recommendation is don't install it on a machine that you care about.
Absolutely.
If someday they decided to do that, they could really sort of allow people to try out all the new features, but protect the system.
Well, and again, I mean, nothing's stopping, somebody in the community to go ahead and build one of these packages, throw it up on a server, and with 4 or 5, could share it out, right? I mean, we might get into licensing issues and freakouts, but my point is, this is going to give a lot of flexibility to people to try out things in safe ways, right?
Except that we're an enterprise product, right? So, as a developer or something, you can't get the bits of SoftGrid, and you can't go and do just that.
Sure.
So that would be the hard part.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk about that. I mean, it's really the first time I've heard of enterprise products that aren't also available to non-enterprise folks, because this could be so useful to testing and backward compatibility testing and stuff. So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, you don't have to get into I understand
sure.
as a business model, we're talking technology here, but just briefly.
So briefly, we're actually sold as part of something called MDOP, which is the Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack.
Ah.
There's always so many syllables in everything that we talk about in Microsoft, it's great. And that is actually something that's sold on top of SA. And so enterprises, you know, they have SA, and then for a small amount more per seat, they can get MDOP. And MDOP has SoftGrid. It also has some other things like Dart, which is the Winternals stuff that we got from Marco Sinovich's company when we bought Winternals. Nice. And they get some, the advanced GPO management and all that kind of stuff. And so they get this pack of things, and SoftGrid is one of those pieces.
Okay.
In reality, you know, that's the way that SoftGrid is sold today.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're just an end user, you can't go buy SA and then buy MDOP and then get SoftGrid. And so that's just how it works.
That's cool. Well, that's important for the audience to know. So, because I'm sure that's one of the first questions Niners are going to ask. Cool, man. How do I get a hold of this?
I think the beta is available publicly. So people could play around with the beta. But as far as, doing anything more than that, they would be restricted.
Understood. All right. Well, let's continue. I mean, we have... So this is interesting. So you have your own file system,
mm-hmm.
two or three or four kernel components, and you wrote your own. Can we dig a little bit into this upcall? I mean, what kind of special things did you have to do? I'm just curious, because you mentioned it was special.
Well, there's not a lot of special things that we really have to do from a software standpoint, because back in the day, before there was like RPC and all those kind of things, a lot of people have implemented their own IPC mechanism, where you have some shared memory, or you have a mutex and a semaphore and whatever, and you basically just cobble together a way to put together a job, signal event or something that wakes up the guy on the other side. He takes the job, does some work, puts the results back in some shared buffer, signals an event, and then it comes back. And that's very similar to what we did. There's basically, in the file system, there is a job queue, right? And the job queue is something that the file system will put requests into that it needs to be serviced. And there is a thread pool up here in the transport that waits on that job queue. And when it sees stuff get put into the job queue, it takes, a thread will take a job out, will go and service it, and will return the results and put it back down. The challenging part is mostly a lot of terminal server customers use us. One of the reasons is that, a couple of reasons, lots of applications don't work on terminal services. Well, they work in that the very first user who launches the application works fine. It's just users 2 through N that don't work. And that's just because applications will do things like they will claim global resources exclusively with the expectation,
I need
how
it all.
How would there be more than one user running on a machine? This is Windows, right? And so they just write the code that way. That's the way their desktop works. That's the way they write their code. And they don't realize on a terminal server, if they take an exclusive lock in a file that's that's in a shared location, no other user can use it. And so with SoftGrid, we make that available. And what that does to this scenario is if you have 100 users all running different applications on the same machine and they all start click to running and doing everything, you can literally get lots and lots and lots of activity in this job queue. And file systems are file systems are a really difficult thing to write. There aren't many companies in the world that have written file systems for good reason. It's really difficult to handle all the concurrency, because you may have, thousands of threads coming into you simultaneously, and you have to make sure that you have your locking hierarchy working correctly. And this job queue is another one of those areas where we have to be very careful about the way that we put jobs into this job queue, the way that they get sent out on the wire, the way that they come back, the way that we validate all the information. Because one of the really touchy things about doing an upcall is if there's a bug in user mode, if you're not really, really careful, you could crash the system. You could blue screen the system. And so, there's a lot of extra validation that has to go around all of the traffic that flows between these two layers to make sure that you don't just take down the system and that you get the consistent information.
Absolutely. So I have a couple of questions. One of them is, what if I try to run an application that requires transactional file system as part of what it does, right? So how does that work with you guys? I mean, you just send the call out to the... So TFX in Vista would be down here, right?
Right.
You just communicate with it.
So we don't actually support transactions today. And luckily, there aren't any consumer applications that require transactions today. And it would really only be if they require transactions on the pieces of the namespace that were in our file system. So if they're talking to the C drive or to their system drive or anything, those transactions are all going to work because that's NTFS, and NTFS speaks transactions very well. If they try to communicate with our file system, the file system type is not NTFS, it's SoftFS.
Okay.
And we do not support transactions, and so if they try to do any operation that required transactions, it just wouldn't work because we don't support it. Like I said, luckily, really, there aren't any commercial applications out there that require transactions. First of all, because they would require Vista, and enterprises always lag the consumers when it comes to adopting new operating systems, because for an enterprise, it is a huge initiative to take on a new version of an operating system and then to regression test all your applications, get it deployed out there. And there probably aren't very many or any large enterprises that are completely homogeneously Vista already, because Vista hasn't been out long enough yet.
So the other thing is, of course, you could write at the application layer if you wanted to be, have an ACID kind of processing model. That doesn't really matter to you. The app can do whatever the hell it wants, right? I mean, I could still write code in my user mode experience where I want to have things happen in transit. In other words, I can sort of make a virtual transaction. Do you understand what I mean? So, because I might want to roll back if something goes wrong. Like, I can that can be inside of my own application intelligence.
If they built their own transaction system, but if they were relying on the operating or on the file system to have transactional capabilities, that would be a problem. In our releases, including the next release after the one we're about to ship, we will support transactions. We will support all those things.
Cool.
And so by the time that Vista becomes ubiquitous, we'll be right there with all of that support. It's just until now we haven't needed it.
But just to kind of cloudify what I said. For example, if you look at the work that's been done in software transactional memory.
Right.
So at the programming level, I can use software transactional memory without a system that's running a transactional file system.
And if the application is like SQL Server, right? SQL Server was built with transactions fully in it without any support from the operating system. Though they had the DTC, but there was no file system support, and yet they're databases, they have their own logging mechanism stuff. Yeah, if an application did that, that would be fine. Normally, that's done on data, not on config, and so that would probably be stored somewhere in the local system, and so they wouldn't run into a problem anyway. So if you virtualize SQL Server, for example, you would still want to put your actual customer data, your database is local, right? And SQL Server could see that fine. And then if the next version of SQL started using the transactional file system functionality, that would still just work.
Absolutely. Now, do you actually see people in the enterprise who might have one machine running? I mean, this is actually an interesting question, because with machine virtualization in the enterprise on the server, with hypervisor, you'd want to run. You pop up virtual machines and have different versions of SQL in them, for example, which kind of makes sense because you want SQL to have the whole OS. You don't want it to be sharing resources with anything else.
Right.
But have you had anyone use application virtualization of SQL, two instances of it?
It's not so much the two instances of it. It's more around the click-to-run experience. So if you virtualize Visual Studio, for example, Visual Studio will lay down SQL. And so people will say, oh, okay, I want the full click-to-run experience for Visual Studio for my enterprise. And that includes the SQL Server experience. And so in that case, really, SQL Server is a desktop application. We don't today do stuff in the data center, mostly because when I mentioned earlier about NT services, you expect NT services to just start up when the system boots and to just run the entire lifetime of it. And today, we just don't do that. We've had lots of customers ask about those scenarios, and we've looked into them, but we haven't really done anything at this point.
Cool. And you could actually run this inside of a virtual machine. I mean, there'd be no problem.
Absolutely. No, not only that, it's actually extremely useful, because the hard part about virtual machines is today management's the most expensive part of owning a system, right? The hardware is commodity; it's next to nothing. Even the software is not as expensive anymore as what it takes to manage that endpoint device. And so, with virtual machines, you've taken the cheapest part of owning a system, and you've made it able to replicate and grow a whole bunch of the hardest part, which is management, right? Because every time you spin up an image of a virtual machine, the moment that it boots, it starts diverging in state, and now you have another whole machine from a management standpoint that you have to manage. So now you have one piece of hardware that used to cost cost a certain amount to manage. Now if you have M virtual machines on it, it's now M times N plus one to manage it. With SoftGrid, you can decouple the applications from the operating system, which means that now that operating system is fairly stateless, so you can just throw it away, right? So if you have your state stored somewhere else and the applications can flow as they need to, well, you can just boot the OS, run everything. When you're done, throw away the image, and the next time that they patch the operating system, you boot, you have all the patches. Right. And this is very interesting for them. Have you guys talked much about VDI?
Not yet.
The virtual desktop infrastructure. It's kind of a model of taking your desktops and moving them to the data center using Hyper-V and saying, I have this block of computing resources, right? And it's a whole bunch of blade servers, server class blades. And I want to carve up those resources using VMs, and I want to run my desktops on there. And the end user just has a lightweight, just a thin terminal. And they basically effectively RDP into their Windows session. And that means that if the hardware goes bad, well, they just reconnect, and they don't know what blade they're on, and no user's tied to any blade. I pull the blade out, I slap a new one in, and I just keep going. It also means I keep all my data in the data center. I keep my applications close to my data. Mm. It's starting to become really popular as one of the ways to manage an enterprise. The hard part about that, again, is if every VM that you boot, mm-hmm. a user's tied to that one VM, that means that if you want to move them to another machine, you have to move that VM, you have to patch that VM, you have to maintain that VM. Mm-hmm. If you have SoftGrid, the user's not tied to the physical instance of the operating system. And so, hey, if I want to go ahead and just have my user connect to any random, you know, instance of Vista that happens to be on any blade, mm-hmm. when they log in, all their apps immediately publish. I have a roaming profile. They see all their data. All their settings roam with them. And so literally, you could be every time that you connect, you're connecting to a different, you know, instance of Vista. And not only that, when the user shuts down, you throw away all the OS state. Mm-hmm. And that means every time you connect, you're connecting to a nice, clean version of Vista that has the most recent patches and has been tested. Mm-hmm. And now your management costs go way down.
Wow, that's incredibly interesting. Very cool. Well, I could just keep talking about this for a lot longer, but I'd like to end with just talking a little bit about why you got into this space in the first place, what your background is. Part of Channel 9 is human.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what's your story? Why did you get into this? How did SoftGrid start? Why did you choose this as a problem space?
Well, me personally, I've always been into operating systems and been, you know, kernel level type stuff. I've written a bunch of my own, like, play operating systems, so I can, nice. You know, try out different resource management schemes, and sort of that's my playground. That's what I do for fun. So when I'm not working in, you know, in software, I'm playing in software. Mm. So I've always sort of had that you know, background for a long time. You know, I came to SoftGrid, or Softricity was the company. You know, they had already started, and they were building the product and sort of getting it working. Mm-hmm. And I came in and became the chief architect for Softricity to first of all, get it working, right? I mean, yeah. This kind of stuff is really, really not easy.
Sure.
I mean, the hard part about it is, you know, the operating system has all kinds of quirky ways that it does things, and applications, without even knowing it, they take dependencies on undocumented behavior, mm-hmm. if you don't replicate that behavior. So that was some of the stuff that we were challenged with. And so before that, I had actually started a couple of companies, and I had worked in, before Softricity, I'd worked at a company called Zevo, where we did large-scale provisioning systems for, like, telcos and, you know, ASPs, and spent a lot of time, actually, with hosted Exchange, which was, you know, Exchange 2000 was never meant to be hosted, never meant to be multi-tenant. And building a system that can provision large, you know, millions of users on hosted Exchange is just it's a pretty hard problem.
Absolutely. So, well, I mean, you look, you know, I must say, I mean, you're the only architect, and you're a very high-level architect for Microsoft who doesn't have gray hair.
Yeah.
It's quite impressive. So did you start right out of high school in these companies, or what?
I actually got my first job, a full job as an engineer, while I was still in college.
Okay.
And it was interesting because it was an environmental engineering of all things. Hmm. And I didn't really have any background in it when I started as, like, an intern. And they hired me full time. And so I was actually working full time as an engineer when I was, like, 19 and going to University of Michigan for engineering school.
Nice.
And, you know, and then after that, I started a couple of companies. And, you know, the thing is, I really started writing software very young. I started first programs I wrote, I was 8. And by the time I was 10, I was working at the or playing at the Museum of Science, mm-hmm. And writing a assembly in C, writing games at that level at 10. And you know, I had a couple of guys that had come out of DEC, who sort of, you know, taught me C and that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. so it was kind of a, you know, kind of a fun way to do it. And so I just always sort of loved it growing up. Originally went to college to be an aerospace engineer, and finally realized that in order to do that, I'd have to live in Florida or Texas or someplace I just didn't want to live. And so so I switched to computer engineering and not even computer science, actually. It was computer engineering, so it's more of the hardware side of it.
Interesting.
But found myself, you know, ended up in software anyway.
Cool. Well, I mean, you're certainly close to the hardware down here.
Sure.
And that's interesting. It's got to be very skilled down in kernel mode because of you can blue screen when you make a mistake. And also, you really understand concurrency. And so the sort of the future when you think about software development and our platform, it's all about how do we take advantage of many core.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the kernel types the kernel type developers are already understanding how to do multiple. But you're an expert at the level that most people aren't up in user land.
Right.
Anyway, I always have to mention ManyCore in all these interviews because it's top of mind across.
Yeah, it's a top of mind for all of us, right? I mean, yeah. It's very interesting from looking at, you know, the changes that Microsoft will have to make to Windows, as pretty soon your desktop will have 64 cores.
Yeah.
You know, and how, you know, and today, you know, 64 cores was data center.
Yeah.
You know, data center edition of Windows was where you'd have 64 cores. Now you'll have a desktop that has it in the near future. And so all of the resource management problems that, you know, that operating systems had to solve in the past become very different when it's many core, you know. Mm-hmm. And so now you can start thinking about things like, you know, assigning cores to processes for long periods of time where they can just, you know, leverage that and sort of maintain their state on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you have a single core, you're constantly swapping out the processor state and the address bus state, and you're flushing the caches on the CPUs. But if you didn't have to do that as often, could you build more, you know, highly performant and more responsive systems? Well, we'll see. You know, we'll see what everyone, you know, what people come up with. But
mm-hmm.
it's definitely a really fun topic to think about.
Absolutely, as is application virtualization and virtualization in general has a very bright future across the industry.
Oh yeah, no, this, I mean, I can tell you, this is the most fun product in the world to work on. It's a blast.
I bet.
And, oh, actually, and I should mention that we're not in Redmond. So the interesting thing is that we were a Boston company that got bought, and we are still in Boston. We're going to remain in Boston. And in Boston, it's really in Cambridge now. So we're basically right on the MIT campus.
Nice.
Microsoft now has a large chunk of the really nice building right on the Charles River.
Mm-hmm.
And we're building up lots of teams there. So there are already a whole bunch of other teams like Microsoft Research.
Mm-hmm.
And Reed Sturdivant owns a group. That's an, like kind of a they call it, I think, applied research, but it's kind of an incubation group that Ray Ozzie is driving.
Nice.
And they're building up a lot there. I mean, even things like the Zoom team is putting some people there, and so there's a lot of activity, a lot of in a short period of time, a lot of flurry of activity in Boston.
Mm.
And so we're starting to become, you know, hopefully pretty soon there'll be a pretty large campus there. And the interesting thing is people inside of Microsoft don't even realize it.
No.
So when we were looking to hire people, there's a lot of people from the East Coast that moved out to Redmond because they wanted to work for Microsoft and mm-hmm. do great things. And now they're starting to see that, oh, there's opportunities
in
other parts of the country, like on the East Coast, where I could still have a great career in Microsoft, but in not work in, you know,
sales or marketing
or something, but work on developing interesting, you know, kernel mode operating system type products, but do it on the East Coast.
Outstanding.
So,
well, that's really cool. Microsoft on the Charles.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, hey, great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Fantastic work, and thanks for coming on Going Deep.
You're welcome.